Welcome to The Learning Curve, a show about helping kids get good grades in school and succeed in life. The Learning Curve is for parents, teachers, and students, because all of life is a learning curve, and you'll succeed to the extent that you can learn easily. Now, here's your hosts, the authors of How to Learn, How to Teach, Overcoming the Seven Barriers to Comprehension, Roger and Virginia.
Today's show is about how to get the best performance and behavior from your children, both at home and at school. And our guest today is Anne Maxwell. Now, Anne is a licensed clinical social worker. She has a wonderful website. It is childfamilyplaytherapy.com. And obviously, childfamilyplaytherapy is all one word, .com. I've been going over this site of yours, Anne, and absolutely fascinating to me. Of course, you've done a lot of clinical work with troubled or otherwise difficult children, but the material on your site speaks so much to the average child and also the gifted child that gives the parents the opportunity to really get it right and enhance the performance of these kids. Very interesting to see these points on your site, and I see you also do teleclasses for parents to help them get this right.
Yes, I did. I have evolved, I think, over time from the perspective of viewing therapy as an attempt to solve problems and to remediate disabilities. And I don't hold to that so much anymore, that belief anymore. I really think that people do the best they can with the information that they have available to them at the time. And this doesn't negate the fact that there are children who've been hideously abused and traumatized and neglected. And in my experience with them, they're incredibly resilient. And my sense is that they actually know what is required in order for them to heal. And when given the possibilities, the opportunities, the choices, they choose that. And they get so much better. And so I'm not a problem-focused person at all. I'm much more hopeful than that. And the work that I do has resulted in kids getting much, much better much more quickly.
I'm very happy to hear that because I like the idea. Roger and I are both very positive, and we look for the positive in things rather than what's the negative and what needs to be fixed. We prefer to look for what's positive and how to enhance it. But a question for you is, how would you define a gifted child?
My sense about, I would define a gifted child as a child whose capacity outstrips what the normal developmental standards are. So, for example, children who read at an early age or who play musical instruments in a way that far outstrips and exceeds their peers. Their kids, gifted kids really, aren't they kids that don't fit into the cubbies that we have assigned to normal development? They just proceed at a rate that's different and that's accelerated in some areas, but not necessarily all areas, which can create difficulties for them.
Yeah, I noticed that in some of your writing here that many of these gifted children are misdiagnosed because being gifted in today's society tend to cause degrees of not fitting in and being excluded by your peers and all that sort of unfortunate scenario. This causes some stress for the gifted kids, and then they get misdiagnosed with the usual catalog of labels, ADD and ADHD and all the rest of the nonsense. Has that been your experience as well?
That absolutely is my experience. ADHD and ADD are two of the most, I think, overused diagnoses around. And oftentimes, that, for example, children in kindergarten who are reading at the second or third or fourth grade level just bored to tears, and they'll act out, be the class clown, they'll do anything to keep themselves stimulated and interested and get diagnosed and sent down to told them they need to be put on meds and sent down to the principal's office, and it's ridiculous. So.
Yes, we actually had an MD on a month, 6 weeks ago, a wonderful man, Dr. Frank Barnhill, who wrote the book Mistaken for ADHD. Did you know that? Do you heard of that book at all?
I haven't, but I will definitely check it.
Oh, yes. The CDC latest statistics cite something in the order of 9.9 million kids have been diagnosed with ADHD, but the other side of the coin is somewhere between 20 and 40% are misdiagnosed.
Right, exactly.
One wonders how many actually gifted children have been now wrongly medicated, wrongly handled, and having their lives sabotaged. So what would you say to parents who this might apply to? What can they do? What should they look for to remedy this situation?
Well, I've involved parents integrally in the work that I do, and what I would ask parents is what they know about their child. They're being told by everybody else, but what they know. I think that one of the things that happens as we grow older from infancy all the way through, awarenesses that we have about what's actually going on that then aren't acknowledged, we tend to discount them and not trust ourselves and think that there's something terribly wrong, when in fact, what if there really isn't anything wrong? What if your child's overexcitability at school is due to the fact that in fourth grade, he knows more math than the math teacher does, and she can't, and forcing him to do it in a way that doesn't work for him, right? Like that kind of thing. And so what I would encourage parents to do always is to ask questions. And questions are questions that are open-ended. They're not statements with a question mark at the end of it. So a question could be, what's going on here? If behavior is a form of communication, and my child is acting out like that, what's he telling us? What's going on in the classroom? Mm-hmm. And not as a blame or finger-pointing kind of thing, but really to get some information, to get some awareness about what could be going on.
Right. To pull some truth out of the situation.
Absolutely.
Rather than try and label it and stick it in a wrong condition.
It sounds to me like what you are describing is also from another show that we had. We have these people on who handle children who are labeled as dyslexic and do not look at dyslexia. What they do is they call them 3D learners. And they learn through three-dimensional pictures. I was wondering, is this what you find with your students or your children?
It's awesome. I'm so glad you brought that up, and I didn't know about the people that you were talking about, but I would love to find out more about them. I think so many of these gifted children, I think some of them actually could be referred to as X-Men, but they just have, their brains are different, and they function differently,
yeah.
And they have extraordinary capacities that many other people don't have, and so one of the ways of communicating to kids is actually to send them the picture. And I've got wonderful examples from the parenting teleclass that I've done, but to send a picture, for example, about homework, of what the experience is like of having their homework completed at night so that they can get a good night's sleep and wake up in the morning without feeling frantic that it didn't get done. And so when you send a picture, you do it energetically. It's not a visual thing.
Yeah, you're talking almost telepathically, send the picture now.
Absolutely.
As a thought process action, right?
Yes, exactly.
Now, these kids will pick up on this, we've observed.
They totally will pick up on it. And what's important to do is to send a picture from their perspective, not from yours. So the picture of homework is not you saying, you get your homework done so you can get a good night's sleep. The picture is, oh, wow, it would be so good if I just finished this because I know I can get it done and then I could get to bed. And how cool would it be to get to school tomorrow and not be so tired?
Mm-hmm.
And it totally works.
Now, one of the things I noticed that you set up now just over a year ago was the Child and Family Play Therapy Center, where you work with the parent and child together, teaching them how to run this kind of a process, if we use that term.
Yes, I do. One of the characteristics of a lot of play therapy is that it's done exclusively with a child in the room. And I found over the years that when parents are involved more closely, that change happens much more quickly and much more dynamically. So I leave the kids in charge, and if they want their parents in the room, their parents are in the room, and if they don't, they're not. And the reason that I leave them in charge is because my sense is that they're in therapy because they feel so out of control in other areas of their life. And so I give them the perception that they're absolutely in charge of the therapeutic process, which actually they are. I mean, they know so much more than we.
Well, in chapter one of our own book, How to Learn How to Teach Overcoming the Seven Barriers to Comprehension, we make the point that there are three stages of decline of a student. In the beginning, of course, they're involved and active, and then as they begin to be given the barriers to comprehension inflicted on them by sometimes parents, unfortunately, unwittingly, they then begin to go into a degree of protest. Then they begin to go into a degree of propitiation, i.e. they try and please the teacher by being good. And then eventually, if none of that works, they just give up and withdraw. And we've just lost a good student. Also in chapter one, we note that all of these students can be recovered. Have you been working on recovery of these kinds of students yourself?
You know, I have, and I love the way you presented that, because it falls in line with one of the beliefs that I have about human development and about parenting families and kids, and it's something that I talk with parents about as well. Isn't it true that when we're growing up, we're actually given two choices? One is that we can either align and agree with our parents, which is to become exactly who they want us to be, or to look like them, or sound like them, or be like them, or do like them, or do what they want us to do, or whatever all of that involves. And the other one is to resist completely and just absolutely refuse to do, be, or have anything to do with anything that they would like us to do. But isn't there another possibility, which is that is to give your kids permission to be who they are, not who you want them to be and not who you didn't become, but really who they are, and to have awareness about where their strengths are and what they love to do and what lights them up. And even if it flies in the face of everything that you've done or the way the rest of your family is, to give that child opportunities to thrive and to develop, to nurture that.
Is that what you mean by be an allowance of them?
Yes, it is. To be an allowance, to give them permission to be who they are in the family that's athletic and sports-minded, to give the artistic child music lessons or dance classes or whatever. It's almost like an adventure. Isn't it true that when we get out of our own particular fixed points of view about the way things should be and the way our families and kids should be and start asking questions, isn't it almost like going on an adventure? It's like, wow, I wonder what we're going to discover, right?
I would absolutely agree, because I think parents probably look at society and say, oh, this is what my kids are supposed to look like, supposed to have, supposed to want, supposed to do. And it doesn't matter what the child wants. They want them to conform with society.
Right. Well, and one of the things that I talk with parents about is I ask them the same questions, like, were you ever given permission to be who you are? I mean, I had a dad in my office a month ago who's in his 50s who admitted to me that one of the things that he really wanted to do was be a musician when he's growing up. He's incredibly talented musically. He's also very bright, and all of his brothers and his dad were engineers, and so he chose an engineering path with the belief that you can't make money or can't raise a family if you're a musician. It's like all of those kinds of beliefs. And how cool would it be if they could break that pattern for themselves and then be who they are, so that their kids can implicitly be given permission to be who they are.
I notice in your website you speak of access consciousness. This is carried out as a practice by asking hugely open-ended questions and allowing the child to really manifest who and what their full potential is, really. Can you give us a little guidance on that?
Yes. Access consciousness is something that I discovered a couple of years ago, and I'm always on the lookout for tools and processes and ways to help, really to empower children and families to change in whatever way they would like to change or to get to wherever they would like to be. And access is a set of tools and processes that are designed to help people change whatever in their lives isn't working for them, mm-hmm. in whatever way they would like to change. So I don't even know how to talk about it. There's not a specific program. It's not a belief system. It's not a set of shoulds and have-tos. So consciousness mission statement is to empower people to know what they know. And I've really taken that into my practice. I have been trained as a traditional therapist, and I also teach access classes in addition to the traditional therapies that I do.
It's good to see you actually getting away from the trying to fix what's wrong paradigm and actually getting into the empowering of our true capacities and abilities. There's a lot more mileage in that one.
There really is. And parents who don't come back to see me again are parents who are invested in the problems. And I say that without any kind of judgment at all. I really do function outside of the box. I really am a believer in change and in choice.
One of our other earlier guests was a Dr. Dean Larson. He had a similar proposition, which he called access knowledge. And I think you're familiar with his work, aren't you?
I am. He's a wonderful, wonderful man, and he's been making huge changes in education, in how schools view kids. And I think he specializes a lot in after-school programs and helping kids sort of get up to snuff academically, and he's done some great work.
I'd like to go back to when you were talking about access consciousness. I think you had said it allows or it helps the person to know what they know or know that they know.
You're so good, Virginia. It's both, actually. I think the longer version is to empower people to know that they know what they know.
So are schools, public schools, are they required to provide advanced classes for gifted children?
No, that's a great idea. I mean, that's a great question. I actually have no idea. I know that I'm sure that the Federal Education Act doesn't it say that every child is entitled to an education and that their educational needs are required to be met. Isn't that true?
That is my understanding, yes.
Right. I know that in the area in which I live, there are schools that have gifted and talented programs, but they're not in every school. And so for whatever the school area is, there'll be one school that will have a GNT program and one school that has an IB program.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It seems like the educational system is emphasizing the what's wrong again by providing so many classes for learning disabled as opposed to providing the same amount of classes for those that are gifted and can move on.
Well, and the rub that I have with learning disabled is that I think that don't you know so many adults who were labeled learning disabled growing up who are actually brilliant? The box was built back in the day, and so they got tagged as learning disabled and tossed into special ed classes, and they're phenomenally, I have a friend who's a phenomenally successful businessman right now.
Mm-hmm.
He's brilliant, who spent much of his school career in special ed classrooms for the learning disabled, and it saddens me. It really does.
Yeah, there was an article in one of the big business magazines, I think it was Fortune or one of those, and they listed about 12 stellar businessmen who were dyslexic or labeled dyslexic and had various degrees of difficulty as students. And it was a who's who of fellows who actually rewrote the book on good corporate practices. Sir Richard Branson,
right.
Virgin,
right.
Airline and Virgin Everything fame, Charles Schwab, started off the internet discount brokerage game, the fellow who created Kinko's. It's a real catalogue. It's a tragedy that the educational system is into this. And, of course, they financially reward people for getting involved in and enrolling in these, quote, learning disabled schools. Talk about a wrong focus.
I have a friend whose daughter is in middle school who's brilliant mathematically, but she can't. She's one of the kids that I refer to as X-Men, the sort of super, super, super brain. And she can't explain how she arrives at the answer. And the reason she can't explain it is, I think, is because her brain works differently. She just gets it in simultaneity. It's the question, and she sees everything, and bam, she hits the answer like that. And she's failing math because she can't explain her work.
Yeah.
That's not fair.
Right? I mean, and she's not alone. I've got that fourth grader whose math skills far outseed the skills of his teacher. His mom is like him, and so she's acting as a buffer, which is a lot. In my sense is that gifted kids come to parents who are like them. So what can you do for your child? What if you could do for your child possibly what wasn't done for you?
That's a good question.
I'm sorry, I just feel the need to express a little outrage here. Here are these gifted children, and we are keep saying about how we don't have any engineers, we don't have anybody who can do math and science, and yet what are we doing to those who can do it? All right, maybe they can't explain how they got it, but you know what? They got the answer. And what are we doing to them? We're saying, oh, you don't fit into our round hole. Therefore, we're going to carve you the best way we can to get you to fit into that hole.
Right. Isn't that ridiculous? And what I say to the parents is, it will be to your child's advantage to learn how to function in this reality. But the mistake I think that's made is to make kids feel wrong that they don't fit in, that they're not like that.
Yes.
But it's almost what I encourage them to do is to teach them how to fit in, not so that they become somebody that they're not, just so that they have more ease in their lives, and to encourage them to create their lives based on who they are. But it's almost like learning another language.
Mm.
Like when you live in Europe, it's a lot easier to speak more than just one language, right? And to learn how to sort of maneuver in this world of square holes and pegs and that. And even if you don't function like that, it is a little bit easier if you know how to do it, but not that you have to become it, just that you know how to be in it.
Yes, actually, it would be a way to be able to communicate your thoughts to others who don't think the same way you do.
Right. So for the kids with the math skills, for example, is to work backwards from the answer to see if they can show the teacher how they got it.
Yeah, why not?
The answer and going down to the question like that. Like those kinds of things.
So in your tools, you say, for children who are emotionally sensitive, don't ask them how they are feeling. Ask instead what they are perceiving. I find it very interesting that you're changing the word from feeling to perceiving. And what is your idea behind what you wrote there?
When you perceive something, isn't it really that you have an awareness of it and that you're observing it? So, for example, as opposed to feeling it, which is when it actually owns you, when you have it. So an example really has almost to do with awareness, too. So I'm going to say two statements to you. One is, wow, that little boy is really being mean to his sister right now. So is that a perception or a feeling?
That sounds like a feeling to me.
Does it? An awareness or an emotion? He's being mean to his sister. And then the second statement is, wow, look how mean he is. He's being so mean to his sister right now. Right? Isn't it? My sense is that there's a difference energetically between perceiving something and
being emotional
and
about
feeling
it.
Feeling it, right. Mm. Being emotional about it. And the perception is much lighter. I think that what happens with these kids is that they're really almost like radio towers, but they pick up so many other people's thoughts and feelings and emotions, and then they actually think that they're theirs. I can't tell you how many kids come into my office with, for example, clinical depression.
Right.
And their parents are clinically depressed and have been for years, and there's sort of the family mystique around how depression runs in the family. And I say to the child, does that belong to you? Is that yours or somebody else's?
That's clever.
Are you just perceiving that? And because it's so intense for you, you think it's actually yours?
Right. They misown it.
And then they lighten up.
Yeah, because the parents unwittingly are projecting telepathically a lot of this stuff on their kids, and the kids effectively misown it or duplicate it or replicate it and run around being it.
And I think that's, you know, you asked me the definition of a gifted child. I think energetically gifted kids are way more perceptive than other people may
yeah.
be, and they have difficulty differentiating between what's theirs and what they're picking up from everybody else around them.
Yeah.
So here's an example. In gymnastics, I was working with an 8-year-old she's training for level 6. I think she's just a phenomenally talented little girl. She's unbelievably good. And before the meets, she would get so nervous. And I said to her, one of the tools is this yours or someone else's, this nervousness? And what she realized was she was picking up the nerves of her of the parents in the room and of some of the kids. And as soon as she realized that it really wasn't hers, that she was just perceiving it, but not actually that it wasn't hers, that she didn't have to feel it, she stopped having that kind of anxiety. I can't remember what it's called now. There's some clinical description. Performance. It went away. It really disappeared when she realized it wasn't hers and it was just somebody else's.
I'm an old champ athlete. I'm 75 now, as my listeners know. In the days just prior to the big events, it's all hyperventilating and adrenaline and nerves. And the joke in the pack is it's very often the community thing. You know, it's not really yours.
Right.
That's a tremendous point to end off today's half an hour with Anne Maxwell. This has been very enlightening, Anne. Folks, I recommend you do go to her website.
ChildFamilyPlayTherapy.com. And Child Family Play Therapy is all one word.
And also, you've got coming up in this 2012 a new series of teleseminars for the parents that they can get this wisdom from you on?
I do. I haven't posted it yet, but I am going to be doing another teleseminar probably starting in February. Mm-hmm. And it's called 10 Keys to Joyful Parenting. It's a wonderful teleclass. Every week there's a tool that we talk about and that parents then get to practice and then talk about the following week, get the next tool, and so on.
Well, thank you very much, Anne, for being with us and passing on. These are really wonderful points of wisdom, even for me, and I thought I knew some stuff.
Thank you so much. You two are wonderful. And I appreciate being invited to be on the show. Thank you.
Next week, we'll be having Anne return, and we'll be discussing her 10 keys to joyful parenting, along with some more tools that you can use to enhance performance of your child, and some wonderful case histories. There's one story Anne tells of a young preschooler who just did not want to go to pre-kindergarten and was actually incorrectly diagnosed by authorities as suffering from some sort of syndrome, and Anne miraculously simply found out what was it that the little person was upset about and having to go to school. And it was a wonderful tale of simplicity of getting to the kid's mind and having the whole problem erased. So next week, return for Anne again.
Thanks for listening to The Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia. For more information on the subjects covered during the show, visit howtolearneasily.com or send an email to questions@howtolearneasily.com.